This episode is brought to you by Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma. When it's time for an aircraft component inspection, overhaul, repair, or replacement, you need experienced technicians you can trust and friendly service you can count on. Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma, a family-owned business since 1959, delivers just that.
Our techs have real-world experience and provide sales, service, and overhaul for piston engine aircraft accessories. We also have limited turbine capabilities such as fuel pumps, starter generators, and prop governors. And we can overhaul propellers ranging from fixed pitch to turbine. Propeller pickup and delivery service is available. And one more thing, mention this podcast to receive 5% off your next sale, service, or overhaul. Visit aircraftaccessoriesofok.com.
This is producer David O'Leary with a quick reminder to our listeners. For the next few months in 2024, we will be releasing several remaining episodes featuring the late Richard McSpadden, including today's episode. We hope you enjoy this edition of There I Was.
At this point, I'm not even really considering fuel because I've flown thousands of hours in a Cessna 172, and the thought of doing a 2.5 to 3 hour flight with full tanks is... It's not concerning. It seems to be a non-issue. So I flew another 0.5, and then it came to that point, and I still felt good. And I was thinking, hey, why not go for 3?
Welcome to another edition of There I Was, a podcast where we put you in the cockpit with pilots in demanding situations, and we learn how they flew out of them. I'm your host, Richard McSpadden. Today's guest is longtime CFI Bill Tomkovic. Bill is a general aviation pilot. He's IFR rated commercial CFI. He's been teaching for decades now, and he flies out of Santa Rosa, California, Charles Schultz Airport. And today he's going to share a story with us about flying his 172 when fuel calculations became a problem. Bill, thanks so much for joining us on the There I Was podcast.
Well, hi. Glad to be here.
Bill, your story is so interesting to us, because it involved fuel calculations, and fuel problems are the 8th leading cause of general aviation accidents, so it's in our top 10. Share your story with us.
Well, I was flying the airplane for the purposes of breaking in a new overhauled engine, and I was flying circles around the airport, a 5-mile radius circle, for a length of time at 2,500 RPM without making any power adjustments so as to break in the engine for the piston rings and valve seats and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, so that's important. Let's just stop and talk about that a little bit, Bill, and that a new engine. First of all, it's kind of interesting to note that Mike Bush will call this infant mortality, right? Is when either a new engine or an overhauled engine within its first few hours of flying, like say first 50 hours or so, is actually the highest potential of having some kind of engine malfunction, much more so than an older engine. So when an engine is a new engine or it's recently overhauled, you're kind of on guard. And also there's a break-in procedure that you need to go through to make sure that those cylinders seat properly and the rings seat. And so talk to us about that procedure. What's the procedure for breaking in a new engine or a newly overhauled engine?
Well, this is the first time for me doing this. Our flight school had done many of them, so I was following their guidance. We were staying within a 5-mile radius of the airport at about 3,000 feet, running the engine at a constant 2,500 RPM without reducing power or making any power changes. That is the prescribed method for breaking in the engine for the first 10, 20 hours. I forget what the number is. And also staying within glide range of the airport, because we just don't trust that engine yet. It's fairly new for the reasons you described there. So it was just flying a 5-mile radius circle around an airport over and over and over and over again. The plan was to go at least 2 hours more if I physically felt up to it.
Yeah, I thought that engine break-in procedure, when I first learned about it, to me it was counterintuitive. I thought, oh, you got a new engine, so you want to baby it for a little bit. That's exactly opposite of what you do.
Yeah.
You go up at altitude and you run it hard for a certain amount of hours, and then you'll alternate your RPM a little bit. But You know, there's a pretty good procedure, and like you said, you almost always do it overhead an airport, you know, just in case. So anyway, that's what you were out to do, was help them break in this new engine.
Yeah, exactly. And the sooner we could get this engine broken in, the sooner we could put it on the flight line and alleviate our current airplane shortage that we have at the school. We are really having difficulty scheduling the students. Business is good. We just need more airplanes. So this was important to get it done as soon as possible, which, to be honest, may have affected my decision-making process.
Yeah, yeah. So you're up there, and walk us through your scenario.
Yeah, so I'm flying for a couple hours. I get to the two-hour mark, and I'm physically okay. My bladder's handling it, and I decide to go for another half an hour. At this point, I'm not even really considering fuel, because I've flown thousands of hours in a Cessna 172, and the thought of doing a 2.5 to 3 hour flight with full tanks is not concerning. It seems to be a non-issue. So I flew another 0.5, and then it came to that point, and I still felt good. And I was thinking, hey, why not go for 3? Again, here's where the, you know, want to get this airplane done as soon as possible comes in. But the problem is I was assuming a 10 gallon per hour consumption rate in the 0360, which is what we've reliably gotten out of past performance in other airplanes and in that airplane that had that engine before it got overhauled. So, and it usually burns a little less than 10 gallons per hour. So it seemed a safe assumption, 10 gallons per hour, and the 38 gallons usable fuel in the tanks. So 3 hours would be 30 gallons. I'd have 8 gallons left, much more than the required half hour reserve. Plus, I'm very short distance from the airport, so it seemed perfectly safe and prudent.
Yeah.
However,
let me ask you this. So it sounds like you were like I am. I fly a 1993 Super Cub. I don't trust my fuel gauges. They're there for broad reference only. So I use timing, which is what you're doing.
Yeah.
But what about your fuel gauges? Did you have fuel gauges in the cockpit?
Yeah. Okay. So earlier in the flight, I had looked at the gauges because they're over by the oil temperature and oil pressure, which I was also monitoring in the ammeter and all that stuff. And I noticed that the left tank was showing less than a quarter tank. This is after maybe less than an hour of flying. So I knew that was wrong. And plus the right tank was showing 3/4 of a tank. So I just knew that was wildly off in terms of fuel consumption. And this is nothing new. I mean, fuel gauges. Oh, gosh. So many times I've just for fun tried to guess how much fuel the airplane would take when fueling it, looking at the gauges, and it's never right.
Especially in those old Cessnas, right? They're just notoriously.
They're terrible. They're terrible. So we teach our students, and this is a good practice, is to always dip the tanks, you know, with a fuel stick and measure physically how much fuel is in the tank, know your consumption rate, and do the simple arithmetic. And you know, add a cushion. I personally usually add an hour. That is prudent. But I have to really say, I didn't even look at the gauges during when I was making the 2.5 versus 3 hour decision. I just thought about the fuel and I did the arithmetic, but I didn't look at the gauges. And even if I had, the difference between 8 gallons remaining and 2 gallons remaining, would it have been that much different on the gauges? I don't know. Maybe if I had seen them both near empty, I would have jumped out of it. But again, there's the, you know, bias, confirmation bias of wanting to go to 3 hours. So I'm not looking for things that contradict that thought, right? So,
and your experience came to play here.
And my experience with gauges aren't that great. So I don't know that that would have overruled it.
Yeah, the gauges, you know, that experience, plus the fact that you've got thousands of hours in a 172. Going 3 hours in a 172 is usually no problem. So that's kind of where your mind is, right? Is you're just not thinking that this is going to be critical.
Yeah. But let me tell you about the crucial thing that happened earlier. Before I began the flight, I topped off the fuel tanks. And the owner of the flight school and I had done a two-hour flight the day before, and at which we topped up prior to the flight. We didn't top off after the flight, so I had to fuel the tanks before I took off that day. And I noticed the fuel truck, the counter on the fuel truck indicated 24 gallons, and I knew that myself and the flight school owner had only flown for a little over 2 hours. So I thought to myself, that's a lot of fuel.
Mm.
And that's all I did with that information. You know, and that should have set off some red flags in my head. Should have said, you know, maybe you need to set a time limit. Maybe you should put a post-it note on the instrument panel or something to remind you that you're, because what it was indicating that it was burning 12 gallons an hour.
Yeah, so this is a little foreshadowing, isn't it? It's like,
Yeah, absolutely. And so one of the lessons, you look for lessons on these things, right? One of the lessons is when you're fueling your airplane, if you're getting an indication of a high fuel burn rate, that's something that needs to be seriously looked at and consider the repercussions of that and make it known to other people that are flying that airplane. Hey, you know, this thing's burning more fuel than it normally does.
I wonder if you do the same thing, Bill. Like, you know, I fly my Super Cub cross country a lot. And I always play a little game with myself that based on the timing that I fly and what my, you know, my altitudes I was flying at and what my fuel gauge says, how much do I think the airplane is going to take in each tank, mm-hmm. right? And as I'm filling, I'm going, I bet this will take, you know, 12 gallons. And then it takes 14 or it only takes 10 or something. And I go, I wonder why I was off there, right? I don't know. Do you play that game with yourself?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Every time I get the tanks filled after a flight with a student and before another one, I do fuel calculation in my head. And I say, and it's like I say, it's a 0360 is always less, a little less than 10. The mm-hmm. 0320 is less than 8, mm-hmm. between 7 and 8.
Yep.
It's fairly reliable.
Yeah, it is. That 8 gallons an hour is very reliable for my 0320 in my Super Cub.
So here's a problem. You know, I mean, we're basing this thing on an assumption of a consumption rate that might not be accurate. I mean, the engine could be, I don't know, wildly out of adjustment on mixture, or mm-hmm. could have a fuel leak in the tank. And so if you're going to completely disregard the gauges, there's nothing, there's no fallback, there's no backstop there for that false assumption, right? And that's what it was in my case here.
So catch us back up to this story. So you gave us that foreshadowing. So you had flown the day before for 2 hours. It took 24 and a half gallons, which in hindsight, that should have told me something. But here you are up there flying. You decide to stretch it for another half hour to go to 3 hours. And I liked in the note you sent, you had made a comment about that was worth considering, this sort of impromptu decision.
Right. It was a spontaneous decision to extend my flight. So when you're in a situation like that where, let's go a little longer, you give some serious deep thought to the fuel problem.
Yeah.
And if I had thought about it a little harder, maybe I would have remembered the fueling that before the flight. And I would have said, well, wait a minute, it's 12 gallons an hour, which would mean that in 3 hours, I would burn 36 gallons in a 38-gallon tank. That's pretty dicey.
But I think you're onto something with that spontaneous thing. I've been thinking about this and talking about it a lot in my recent seminars, and that is that we need to be careful of impromptu decisions in aviation.
Yeah.
Because typically when we're going cross country or we're, you know, going on a training flight with a student, we put a lot of preparation into it, and there's a lot of thought, and we think about our primary plan. We have backups and contingencies, right? And so we're prepared for that. Whereas when we get in the cockpit and we make these impromptu decisions, it doesn't have all of that preparation. So what it means is it's easier for something to slip through the cracks, one of your typical calculations.
Right, and consider this flight was within 5 miles of an airport at all times. So everything seems all the more safer.
Yeah. So I've just begun to think that, you know, you have what you plan to do. And then every flight's usually every flight's a little different than what you plan. Something happens, weather, winds, you know, who knows. But the difference between what you actually fly and what you plan to fly, that gap to me is filled by risk. So the larger that difference between what you plan and what you actually fly, the more risk that you're taking on a flight. It's just a concept that I'm playing with to help remind me of the challenges of spontaneous or impromptu decisions.
Yeah, I think you're right on there. I didn't really have that much of a plan on this flight, however. It was just to fly at least 2 hours, maybe more. That's the plan, right? And
yeah,
just having
yeah.
a general knowledge that 3 hours is safe in an 0360, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But absolutely, your point is a good one.
Bill, I'm putting myself in your cockpit because I've done the same thing. I had to, in my previous Super Cub, I top overhauled it and had to break in the engine. And I was doing exactly what you were doing. You know you're going to be up there just droning holes in the sky, and you go, okay, I'll just do it for an hour today. Oh, I'm feeling good enough. I'll go another half hour, right? I did the exact same thing. So I'm there with you. I know exactly what you're thinking. You're trying to get the hours log that you need on this airplane.
Yeah.
Hey, David, I got a riddle for you. How can you upgrade your next flight without upgrading your airplane?
I think upgrading the pilot would be the first clue for that one.
The guy between the headsets, huh? Yeah.
That's right.
All right. That's not what I'm talking about, but I'll give you a clue. It has ADS-B traffic and weather, Sirius XM weather and entertainment, no wires, and it works with 4Flight and Garmin Pilot.
Oh, Ian, I know what that is. It's the Garmin GDL52 Sirius XM portable weather receiver.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. And now, believe it or not, the Garmin GDL52 comes with a 3-month trial of Sirius XM aviation weather and a very special limited time $400 rebate. Learn more about all that this receiver can do and the limited time $400 rebate by visiting sporties.com/GDL52.
So then what? Take us from there. You decide to go the extra half hour.
Yeah. So the rest is kind of predictable. At the 3-hour point, again, I'm less than 5 miles from the airport. I call the tower, say, okay, I'm talking with them the whole time because this guy's a little bored. I'm bored. So we come in and he clears me to land on the runway, which is 1-4. And again, procedures on a new engine, you don't want to shock cool it. I don't want to just pull the throttle back and make a steep approach, staying within glide distance the whole time. Had to make a shallow approach in order to keep the RPMs up. And so I got outside of the gliding range of the airport briefly. But as it turns out, that was the exact moment the fuel ran out. So I was about between 2.5 to 3 miles out when the engine quit. I was about around 1,400 feet, 1,400 feet. And the engine just shut down. I just like pulling the mixture. It just shut off. So the first few seconds, I'm trying to decide if this is really happening. I push the throttle in. I pull it. I'm pushing the throttle. Nothing's happening. And then I, okay, let's do what we do. What I teach my students almost every other day, best glide, pitch for best glide. Look for a place to land. Well, I'm going to land at the airport. That's what I'm doing. So I think, okay, I'll glide into the airport on my best glide, 80 miles per hour in that particular airplane. And then I run through, okay, let's check the fuel selectors on both. The fuel mixture's rich. The fuel primer's in. The carburetor heat is on. Try the left mag. Try the right mag. Nothing's happening. The engine's not running. And then I look again at my aim point that you can see where you're going to touch the ground on your current descent angle, and I can see that is well short of the airport. Another note here that when an engine quits on a 172, the glide angle is a bit steeper. That windmilling prop is not the same as just pulling the prop to idle. You don't get as much range. So I'm looking for a place to land. I think initially I think I can make the golf course short of the runway, but then I realize I can't even make that. So I told the tower, I saw a construction site to my right that had some freshly bulldozed dirt on a field. I couldn't tell much else about it, but there was nothing else around. There was houses and trees, just crummy. And so I set up to go there. I didn't want to be short of that landing area, so unfortunately I got there a little too high. And I put in full flaps. I was slipping with full flaps. I know Cessna says not to do that, but I'm trying to get the airplane down. And it's apparent that if I continue to try to land it on that field, I'm going to run off the end. And at the end is trees, houses, bad stuff. And plus that landing area doesn't look so good now that I'm close up to it. It has all kind of hills and a creek or something running through it. So on my left, I can see a vineyard and I see that the rose are pointing at me. So if I just turn left and go into that vineyard, I'll be landing parallel to the grapevines. Because a vineyard has the grapevines and then it has posts, mm-hmm. metal posts with wires that suspend the grapevines and hold them up. So if you you know, were to hit there across the wires, a good stand, you might trip the gear and, you know, nose over. So land, if you're going to land in a vineyard, I've always told students, and we always, you know, that's the lore around here in wine country, is if you land in a vineyard, at least land parallel to the row. So that I knew I could do that. And at that point, I'm just trying to stay alive, not, you know, to worry too much about the airplane. And so I aimed for the vineyard, and I just flared as if I were to land on the top of the grape plants, which is about three and a half, 4 feet above the ground. And I don't know if it stalled or not. I got a stall warning horn. I remember that. And then there was just a bunch of whack, 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 whack as all the posts and vines and everything hit the airplane. And it was a landing roll of about 80 feet because all that green vegetation, it absorbs the force pretty well. And smooth deceleration, I have to say. I got pressed up against the seatbelt and the shoulder harness as if you had slammed the brakes on in your car. It was no more than that.
But no injuries?
Not harmed in the least. No, that was absolutely unhurt. And once I realized I was going to live through this thing, you know, fairly unshaken at that point, too, I was trying to find my cell phone because it went flying along with everything else that was on the right seat that I had there, so that I could call the tower and tell them I was okay. I'm only 2 miles off the end of the runway, right? So eventually I did, couldn't find a phone. So I decided, okay, we'll turn the electrical system back off because I had turned it off prior to landing. So yeah, right prior to landing, I tightened my seatbelts, turned off the electrical. I did all that sort of stuff too. So I turned on the electrical system, determined it was safe to do that. There's no fuel leaking and called them and told them I was okay. And I was a sole occupant. Instructional flight for a helicopter school was right overhead immediately because they had heard the radio traffic and they were right there. So they located me, and then the sheriff's helicopter came in, landed nearby, and then hiked down to me, and I was already up and out of the airplane and, you know, just taking it all in at that point. And that was pretty much the end of it.
Yeah.
They helicoptered the plane out. They put it in a sling and lifted it with a helicopter and put it in a hangar the next morning. So they didn't spend that much time.
Was there much damage done to the airplane?
Oh, there was a lot. Oh, God, there's a lot of damage. That's the problem. It tore a hole in the leading edge of the right wing. Both flaps were fully down, so they took a beating. They got a hole in each one of those. The tail, the right horizontal stabilizer, hit something and tore off the outer third of the stabilizer and the elevator. And that torque bent the tail cone a bit so that there's an indentation on the left side where it got bent over. So, and then the propeller, the one blade of the propeller was bent back. And the other's not, but I guess they're still going to probably want to do an engine teardown. So that's, you know, it's all very expensive.
Well, you know, the irony of this is that you had a plan to take off and stay overhead the field in case something happened with the engine, and you'd been doing that for 3 hours, and you give that up for just a little bit. I mean, relatively small window that you were outside of that glide range, and sure enough, that's when your problem is. Yeah.
Seconds. I figure if this engine had run 10 more seconds or more, 10, 12 more seconds, I would have been on the ground in the airport. If it had happened earlier, I would have had more field opportunities behind me. I would have had better landing areas. It just really did happen at the worst time. And I remember thinking to myself, that irony occurred to me at the moment that I realized that the engine had really failed. It's like, okay, now you decide to fail. You know, I mean, that was,
yeah.
I was, just by the unfairness of it all.
Yeah. But you know what seemed to really help you is in two situations in that short span, you didn't fight your reality. You accepted it. This engine has quit. You were working to try to get it back, doing all the things, you know, from memory that your procedures had drilled into you, and you were doing those. No time to reference a checklist. But you accepted, okay, I'm not going to make the airport. I'm not going to make the golf course. So you were going into this other place, and then you realize I'm too high for that.
Yeah.
And I think at any point in there, if you'd have fought that reality by hope, sometimes hope is not our friend, it fights with reality, then you would have found yourself with a potentially disastrous outcome.
The temptation to deny that reality is really strong. It's It's a fight with yourself almost that you make yourself accept that this has really happened and that you've got to deal appropriately, you know. And I think if I were to do this in a calm situation, like, okay, land in that field. Here, I'm going to cut your engine here. I want you to put, I would have come in. I would have made a better approach. I would have managed the airspeed a little better. I would have maybe made some S turns or whatever while approaching the field. But man, when your life depends on it, thinking is not, you don't deal with subtlety all that much. You know, it's kind of hard to.
Yeah. Well, you know what? While we're on that topic, so we in the Air Safety Institute, we did a little bit of research of what's going on with you physically when something happens in your cockpit that's alarming, that, you know, threatens you, right?
Mm-hmm.
And physically what happens is your eyes will tend to focus, so you get tunnel vision on what your brain thinks is the most important thing for you to look at. You'll get sort of tunnel hearing, so your brain will filter out a lot of sounds that it doesn't think are important. Your breathing increases, your blood flow to your muscles increase. And essentially what's happening is your body is optimizing a physical response for fight or flight kind of response at the expense of your cognitive response. So it's ironic for us as pilots that just as at the time when you need your best cognitive processing, you're not optimized for that. You're optimized for physical reaction when you're stuck inside this cockpit.
Yeah.
So I think you were referencing that in how you were sort of fighting through this situation.
Yeah, it's almost like an adrenaline fog, you know. I was a firefighter for 30 years, so I've had stressful situations before, and I've seen other people in stressful situations and how they react. And I know it's very hard to predict from person to person or even the same person from day to day how you're going to react in that kind of situation. But I think there's always the – you're not at your best thinking. You're not as prone to – correct mistakes, for example. If you start on the wrong path, you tend to stay on it. So it's an interesting field of study for somebody, I'm sure.
Well, a lot of the research that we reviewed came from first responders, from firefighters and police officers, and how they deal with suddenly you're in this emergency situation. How is your body physically responding? And sometimes it turns out in the way that it's responding is not optimal to us inside the cockpit.
It seldom is.
And the other thing that was interesting is it only took you 80 feet to stop. Now, some of that was helped by, you know, banging your things, hitting the wings and so forth. But still, it sort of makes the point to us that when we're looking for an off-field landing site, you don't need some massive field. If you can just get down in a slow enough airspeed like you did so you can dissipate your energy, all you need is about 100 feet, and you're going to survive it.
Well, in this case, 80 feet of pavement, I don't know that I would have stopped in, right?
Right.
It's smashing through those grape plants that...
Yeah.
It was just the smooth, even deceleration. You know, it's like I've heard before, landing in a cornfield is really good for that. It absorbs the deceleration evenly. So there's not a big shock at the end or at the start, you know, like running into a concrete wall would be, you know, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's kind of like almost like row crops are not a bad choice if, you know, you're just looking to survive at this point. You're not looking to fly the airplane out of there. You just want to stay alive. Turns out that was not a bad choice.
Yeah. At that point, the airplane just becomes a capsule to protect your body, you know, at that point. And if you can just dissipate that energy, you'll survive. And then what was interesting to me is you said it wasn't really that violent, yet it still shook all kinds of items in your cockpit that went loose, like your cell phone that you couldn't find. So it's kind of a reminder to all of us. You jump in the airplane, you think you're just going to go fly, put your phone or your iPad on the seat. Yeah, it's a good chance, you know, if something happens, you're not going to be able to find that or access it. And it could be a projectile that's floating around the cockpit that could hurt someone.
Yeah. Yeah, good point.
Well, what an interesting ordeal. So let's go back to the fuel calculation. So I guess it turns out that this new engine, maybe because you were running it harder, but why did it burn 12.5 gallons an hour as opposed to the typical 10 an hour?
Well, I don't know, but I have my ideas. We are running at full rich, for one.
Yeah.
Normally we would lean, and I think the fuel consumption tables assume leaning an engine. But when we're doing flight instruction, we're constantly changing the power and altitude. We usually don't lean the mixture for flight instruction either. So I don't think that's the entire answer. Maybe when the piston rings are not quite seated, there's a lot of blow through, you know, they're not getting as efficient compression strokes. The valves and the piston seats are sealing. Maybe fuel consumption is high just because of that. I don't honestly know the complete answer to this.
Yeah. Interesting that your observation is the clue was in the flight previous. And one of the lessons I take away from this, because it happens to us all the time in the cockpit, is you see something that's unusual, but it's not impactful to you at the time. So you end up going, 24, huh, that seems like a lot. Well, you know, back to whatever it is you were doing.
Yeah.
Right?
In this case, I was waiting for the last thing I had to do before beginning the flight was get fuel, because I had done the pre-flight inspection and everything. Waiting for the fuel truck. Okay, the fuel truck's here. I got my fuel. Time to go.
Yeah.
So I didn't linger on the fuel thing too long because I was getting on with my business. So.
Yeah. A lesson for all of us, you know, if that something sort of triggers that response out of you, maybe it's worth pausing on that just a little bit, all of us, to think, is that going to impact me or not? So that's a takeaway for the rest of us.
Yeah. One of the fuel gauge thing is I know we can't really rely on them. We have to do our consumption-based calculations. But it has an assumption of a consumption rate that might not be the same. And like I said, you could have a leak in your tank or something. We should consider that if the gauges show less than we think, that maybe we should believe them in that case. I don't know, but we can't completely ignore them.
Yeah.
I think there has to be some.
I think it's a very good point. Yep.
There was a, you've probably heard of the accident. Air Canada, the 757 ran out of fuel, had to land on a drag strip that was a former Canadian Air Force base.
Yep.
So they did a fuel calculation based on 2,300 kilograms, and what they had actually put in the airplane was 2,300 pounds. So halfway through the flight, their fuel totalizer is looking at the fuel flow, knowing what was in the airplane to start, and was showing them how much fuel they had, which was everything was just serendipity going along. And so, of course, they ran out of fuel halfway to where they were going. And they said that they didn't, their fuel gauges, they don't know. They didn't look at them. They didn't trust them. They knew they were no good. The same thing.
Mm. Well, some good lessons learned. Anything else that we should chat about that we can take away from this incident, Bill?
Well, I always said that I would teach my students, you know, calculate the fuel consumption, always dip the tanks, never trust the fuel gauges. And the other thing I would tell them is if you run out of fuel, it's your fault. There's no excuse for running out of fuel. And I pretty much still hold to that. I think I could have done this better. I think we can all do a little better on that. At the end of the day, I'm still at fault here.
Well, thanks so much for being willing to share your story with us. There's a lot of lessons learned for the rest of us that we can take away from this, and we appreciate your sharing your time with us.
Not a problem. If I can help prevent another thing like this, it'd be very worthwhile.
Well, that's interesting to hear a longtime CFI analyze himself and his actions in a scenario that ended up in a mishap and a fuel exhaustion. When I listen to scenarios and I read through mishaps, I take the perspective of, at the time, the pilot was doing what they thought was logical. And to me, it gets interesting when we realize that, and then realize we can sit here now and realize it wasn't logical action, but what about it in the moment set the pilot up to think that those were good actions, a good course of action? And that's when we'll really analyze the situation and take the learnings from it. So we're so grateful for Bill for sharing his story in a very candid fashion. Thanks for joining us on this edition of There I Was. Alongside our producer, David O'Leary, I'm your host, Richard McSpadden. Until next time, fly safe. Hey, listeners, we want to thank you for making this one of the most popular aviation podcasts there is. Thanks to you, our listeners, for your engagement, for following us, and for your likes and subscribes on whether it's iTunes or Spotify. Those mean a lot to us and help us expand the aviation reach and our aviation safety message. If you'd like to help us and become a supporter of these podcasts, please consider a donation to the AOPA Foundation. That's aopafoundation.org. Thanks for your support, and thanks for making this podcast so successful.
There I Was is produced by the AOPA Air Safety Institute. If you'd like to hear other episodes, submit comments, or submit your own story to potentially be featured on the show, please visit airsafetyinstitute.org/thereiwas. Thanks for listening.